All right, diving in today, folks, we're going deep. We're talking about a super, like, pivotal area of the law. It's where these, like, really difficult issues of repressed memories of child sexual abuse slam right into the statute of limitations.
Yeah, it's heady stuff, for sure.
We're breaking down a Texas Supreme Court case, SVVRV. And listen up, you law students out there. You've really got to wrap your heads around this one. It's huge for so many reasons. Evidence, torts, civil procedure, like all that good stuff.
You know, it really gets to the heart of justice, doesn't it? How the law tries to handle these traumatic experiences that, you know, might surface years later.
So anyone starting out in law, this case is like a masterclass. It shows how all these different legal concepts, they all kind of crash into each other.
It really does. And the policy considerations that judges have to weigh, it's fascinating stuff.
Okay, so let's get the facts straight in it, SVVRV. We've got RV, 20 years old. And she's accusing her father, SV, of sexual abuse. And this abuse allegedly went on for, like, a really long time.
Yeah, 13 years, from when she was just 4 to 17.
Tragic. But the thing that throws a wrench in everything, legally speaking, RV says she didn't remember any of this until she was 19.
And that's where it gets tricky. Most places, Texas included, have these statutes of limitations for filing lawsuits.
Right. Deadlines.
Exactly. In Texas, you've generally got 2 years from when you turn 18 for personal injury claims. Sexual abuse falls under that. So at first glance, her lawsuit at 20 seems like she missed the deadline.
Yeah. And the trial court, they agreed with the dad, dismissed the case, statute of limitations, done. But then the appeals court, they said, hold on.
Yeah.
Brought the case back to life.
Sent it right up to the Texas Supreme Court. Back and forth, you can see how much debate this whole thing caused.
So we've got the central question. When someone says they've got repressed memories, can those memories change the legal timeline? Can repressed memory hit pause on the clock?
Right. And as you mentioned, the way this case bounced around the courts, from the directed verdict to the appeals court, then up to the Supreme Court, it really shows how much the legal system is wrestling with these new kinds of claims.
So the million-dollar question in SVVRV, the core legal issue, boils down to, does the discovery rule apply? Specifically, when someone's saying, hey, I just recovered repressed memories of childhood sexual abuse. Now, quick breakdown for anyone new to this. What's the discovery rule? Why is it so important in these kind of cases?
Think of the discovery rule like a safety net. It's there for situations where, you know, you wouldn't reasonably know you were harmed right away. It basically says the legal clock doesn't start until the injured person knows or should have known about the injury.
It's there to keep things fair.
Exactly. So someone doesn't get screwed just because they didn't realize they had a claim until later. Like, imagine a doctor leaves a surgical tool inside a patient. The patient might not have a clue for years.
Oh, geez, that's a good example.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be pretty messed up to punish someone for not suing within the normal time frame when they didn't even know they were hurt. But in RV's case, repressed memories, did the Texas Supreme Court buy it? Did they apply the discovery rule?
They did not. And that's a big deal. It really shaped how these cases are going to go down in Texas from now on.
So tell me, why did they say no? What was their reasoning for not using the discovery rule in a repressed memory situation?
Okay, so their decision was all about this two-part test they use in Texas to figure out if the discovery rule even applies. First, they got to see if the injury was inherently undiscoverable. And second, they need objective verification to prove there was actually wrongdoing and that it caused the injury.
Okay, two parts. Got it. Let's start with inherently undiscoverable. What the heck does that even mean in this situation?
Inherently undiscoverable means basically it's unlikely someone would figure out they were injured, even if they were doing everything right, like using reasonable diligence to figure things out. Like, say someone gets sick way down line because of exposure to, like, some toxic chemical. It could take years for them to connect the dots.
Yeah, cause and effect. Sometimes it takes a while. So that's part one. What about this objective verification?
This is where it gets tricky. Basically, you need more than just the person's word that something bad happened. You need some kind of solid proof. You know, records, witnesses, something concrete to back up the claim, especially after so much time has passed.
Makes sense. Memories can be fuzzy, right?
Yeah.
Especially after a long time. So how did the Texas Supreme Court apply those two tests to RV's case? Repressed memories, alleged abuse. Did it hold up?
Not really. On the first part, inherently undiscoverable, the court really focused on how long the abuse supposedly went on.
Yeah, 13 years, we said.
And that it happened at home, within the family. So the judges were basically like, come on, 13 years at home, really inherently undiscoverable.
It seems like they were skeptical that abuse like that could go on for so long in a family setting, and the victim would never, ever have any awareness of it. What about the need for solid proof, that second part of the test?
That's where the whole scientific debate about repressed memory really came into play. The court was super clear that there's no scientific consensus on repressed memories. Like, do they exist? How reliable are they? It's all up in the air.
Big questions.
Justice Hecht, the guy who wrote the majority opinion, he said, and I'm quoting here, "Expert testimony on subjects about which there is no settled scientific view cannot provide objective verification." So basically, an expert can't just come in and say repressed memories are real, therefore this abuse happened. That's not enough.
Seems like the court was seriously doubting whether expert opinions on repressed memories can actually prove anything about whether abuse really took place.
They even said they were worried that accepting repressed memories alone could open the floodgates to a bunch of old, impossible-to-prove claims.
So they're trying to balance things out, right? Trying to protect victims, but also make sure the legal system isn't swamped with unreliable cases.
So they basically decided it's more important to prevent those old, maybe false claims, than to let cases move forward based on recovered memories alone. Huge implication. Yeah, and it wasn't a unanimous decision, you know? We got to talk about the dissent and the concurrences because they offer different ways of looking at the whole thing.
Right. Those other opinions are important, too. They show just how complex this issue is. So break it down. What was the main argument in the dissent?
Justice Owen, she wrote the dissent, and she had a completely different take. She argued that, look, the relationship between a parent and a child, it's inherently unequal.
Right. A kid depends on their parents. Trust them.
Exactly. And she said that power dynamic, that trust, it creates this situation where abuse can be hidden, not just from everyone else, but even from the child themselves.
Like a coping mechanism, blocking it out.
Exactly. So Justice Owen saying that repressed memories, especially in this kind of situation, they are inherently undiscoverable because of what the abuser did and how trauma messes with a child's mind. And she went even further, saying that experts can provide enough proof of abuse if you look at the whole picture. Like, if the expert's opinion is backed up by other circumstantial evidence, and the victim consistently tells the same story after they recover those memories.
So for Justice Owen, the majority's decision basically punishes victims for repressing memories, which is a natural response to trauma, right? A direct result of what they went through.
That's the heart of her argument. She felt like the majority didn't really get the psychological dynamics at play, how abuse affects a child's memory, and how that plays out later on.
Now, what about the justices who agreed with the outcome, but maybe for different reasons? The concurring opinions, what did they say?
Right, so we've got Justice Gonzalez and Justice Cornyn. They both agreed to dismiss Arby's case, but their reasoning, different paths to the same destination. Justice Gonzalez, he was focused on the type of claim. He said, look, Arby's allegations, they point to intentional abuse, not negligence. And most of the arguments about the statute of limitations and the discovery rule, they were about negligence. So he's like, even without getting into the repressed memory stuff, that negligence claim doesn't fly. And then he also kind of echoed the majority's doubts about expert testimony on repressed memory. He said it didn't meet the tough standards for scientific evidence in Texas, you know, the Robinson standard, which is basically like the federal Daubert standard.
Gotcha. So for him, it wasn't just about the discovery rule or repressed memories. It was about how the alleged abuse was legally categorized and whether the expert's opinion was even admissible in court.
Exactly. Then you've got Justice Cornyn. He agreed with the result, but added a little warning. He was a bit worried about the majority going into so much detail about the specific facts of the case, and he was concerned that their discussion about expert testimony on repressed memories could muddy the waters for future cases. Like, could it mess with how courts apply the Robinson standard for expert testimony in general?
Wow, so many angles. It's really interesting how they all ended up in the same place, dismissing the case, but through these totally different legal pathways. Really shows how legal reasoning works. Like, different judges focus on different aspects of the law and evidence.
Definitely a good lesson for law students. Legal analysis isn't always cut and dry.
Okay, so zooming out, what does all this mean for the legal landscape in Texas? And for law students, what's the takeaway here? What should they be thinking about for their future practice?
SVVRV, it lays bare this fundamental conflict in the legal system. We want justice for victims of abuse, even if it happened a long time ago, but we also need reliable evidence. Plus, you got to be practical, right? Dealing with claims from years ago, it can get messy. So courts, they're cautious, especially when there's not much to back up the claim.
Makes sense. But like Justice Owen pointed out, what about the effects of trauma on memory? If someone represses memory, shouldn't that be considered?
Exactly. It's this balancing act, this tightrope walk between wanting to support survivors and making sure the legal system is strong and doesn't crumble under potentially false claims.
Tough stuff. So what's the advice for future lawyers?
The biggest thing, based on SVVRV, is that in these repressed memory cases, lawyers need to find hard evidence.
Objective evidence, right? What the court called it.
Yep. That could be anything. Medical records, maybe someone told a friend or family member something back then, even if it wasn't the whole story. School records, anything that shows a change in behavior. Basically, you need something more than just the victim's memories and an expert talking about repressed memory.
So just having an expert explain repressed memory, that's not going to cut it in Texas, especially if you're trying to get around the statute of limitations.
That's what this case tells us. Texas courts, at least for now, are going to be super strict about that. They want to see real, tangible proof.
So the big lesson, the takeaway, if you're dealing with a repressed memory case in Texas, you got to prove two things. One, that the injury was inherently undiscoverable, and two, that there's real solid evidence to back up the claim. And SDVRV, it shows us that just having repressed memories without any other proof, that's not enough for the Texas Supreme Court.
Couldn't have said it better myself. That's the core legal principle we're left with. This case, it's like a roadmap. It shows exactly where things stand in Texas right now.
This deep dive, it's been, well, deep. We've been talking about SCVRV, and it raises so many questions about justice, about how memory works, and the long-term impact of trauma. Big stuff.
Yeah. Anyone studying law, you need to know this case. It's like a foundation for understanding torts, evidence, procedure, the whole nine yards.
To wrap things up, we've learned how the Texas Supreme Court approaches the discovery rule when you're talking about repressed memories of child sexual abuse. They want to see that the injury was impossible to discover right away and that there's proof beyond just the memories themselves.
And that brings us to a question for everyone listening. Trauma and memory, they're connected in ways we don't totally understand. And different states, they have different ways of dealing with this legally. Maybe we'll explore that another time. But think about this. What's the fairest, most effective way for the legal system to handle these claims of abuse from the past? How do we make sure everyone gets a fair shake, the victims and the accused? And how do we prevent false accusations? SVVRV really brings that tension to the forefront.
Lots to ponder. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.
It's been a pleasure.
Until next time. Keep those legal minds sharp.